Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And The Personal Wealth Coach, this is our official disclosure, in case you were wondering, is not only a delightful, wonderful, and exciting... No, that may not be true. It may be perceived as a... Well, under some circumstances, you may perceive it as a delightful, wonderful, and exciting...
All right, let's just be truthful. It is a boring economics radio program.
Yes, and but it also is the name of a wealth management investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States that happens to be located in Salado, Texas, and files all kinds of official documents with the SEC and is regulated by said agency.
Who said?
Who said?
Who said agency?
I did.
Ah, okay.
I'm Jeff, and this is Jeff McClure, and I represent that.
Yes,
and no, this I authorize this program.
Yes, and this is Jake McClure, and I authorized me to speak.
Oh, good. Okay, now we're ready. Anything else we need?
You dotted all of the T's and crossed all of the I's.
Got it.
My eyes are very crossed.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the stock market existed all week.
Hmm.
At least during business hours.
All right, that's the news, and now on to the next. No.
And the S&P 500 for the week, now this is horrible, this is shocking, is down
0.1%.
0.1%? Yes.
Okay, for the week.
And the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the week was up 0.44%.
Okay.
Anything else you need to know?
Nothing really exciting happened in the markets this week.
The NASDAQ Composite was down 0.13%.
Okay.
And interest rates continued to rise and the bond market continued to fall. Oh, that sounds all very good. Until you look at a little longer term and you realize that the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index this year is up about a little over about 10.5%. And from a year ago, it's up a little over 12%. So that's good. But in the short term, it kind of leveled off and didn't do a lot this week, which is significant. And it's significant because... I bet you already know why it's significant because.
Tell me.
The Federal Reserve raised interest rates officially. I say, actually, the Open Market Committee of the United States Federal Reserve Board raised the interbank lending rates from their previous level of 0.25 to 0.5% up to a new level of 0.5 to 0.75%, which is a quarter point raise. And you say, well, okay, everybody was ready for that, and the market didn't collapse. In fact, the Dow went up.
Well, another little piece that happened this last week, it's between the over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It's in some ways compared to what we saw earlier this year and especially last year, OPEC came to some conclusions. And not only did they come to their own conclusions, they brought Russia in as well, and they said they were going to cut output. By cut, what they meant is keep it the same as it was this year for next year, which means they're not going to expand.
Which is like all the other agreements they've had recently and will be broken immediately by somebody.
Right. Well, so the concept here is that we had two pieces of news that within the last 6 months, if those two pieces of news had come out in a week, we would have had mass panic. There would have been people running around stockpiling water and looking for zombies.
Last year... At the same meeting, the December meeting last year, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates from, and I'm going to use the base interest rate, 0 to 0.25. The stock market promptly dropped 3.5% the following day, and over the next several months was down about 20%. There were other reasons theoretically, like the fact that the price of oil dropped, but... One of the driving factors was the Federal Reserve was being reckless and was probably going to plunge us into a recession.
Horrible recession.
Because they had raised rates from 0 to 0.25.
Right.
And this time, not only did they raise rates from 0.25 to 0.5, that's the base rate, they also said, hey, we anticipate raising rates three more times next year, which would, if you add the 0.5 to 0.75, you get up to 1.25%. So we will have come in 2 years then from effectively zero interest rate to 1.25, which is in light of all that we know about the big wide world, a really big move.
And as a market, percentage, from 0.0 to 1.75%.
That's infinity.
That's an infinite rise in interest rates.
Right. But the markets reacted, okay.
Well, it's like the least surprising moment in the world. It's basically everybody knew it was going to happen. But put in context with what you were just saying, historically, it caused earth shakes and earthquakes in the market in the recent past. And now it's just, shrug, go on.
Meh, that's it.
Where's the emoji for the radio? We got to put some emojis for shrugging and meh. All right, so.
It's a new word that I've only recently learned is meh.
Before we go any further, let me explain what happens when the Federal Open Market Committee meets. What is it? What is that group? Why is it that the Fed is raising interest rates, and how did the government do that? Well, it's not the government, first off. So this is some stuff. I'm going to start with the biggest misconceptions. People think that the Fed or the Federal Reserve, because it says Fed in it, must be like the Feds, like the FBI or something like that. It is not. It's a group of bankers. The top people in that committee are appointed by the president and approved by the Senate, because they don't want bankers to be running a monopoly. They want government-appointed people with the job of not making huge profits, but the job of making sure that the banks control inflation and deflation in charge.
And one other thing. What's two mandates.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Stability of the dollar, which means low inflation, and?
And also, there's
minimum unemployment.
There are three mandates.
There's a third one. What's the third one?
Yes, it is to stabilize the marketplace. And these are both right after the Great Recession. The unemployment and stability of the marketplace are both things that the Federal Reserve is being given the responsibility of, but they don't get to hire a lot of people.
Well, if they really, since they're composed of a bunch of banks and they're owned by the banks across the country, they could affect the unemployment situation very nicely. They just need to go out and hire a lot of people.
Okay, so this leads us to the next step. How is it that they are supposed to prevent inflation or too much deflation? How is it that they're supposed to help with unemployment? And how is it that they're supposed to create stability in the marketplace? They have a series of tools. Know that these are bankers. One of the things that we have in the Federal Reserve Act is that we require banks that are part of the Federal Reserve System, which is most of the big banks out there. If you know a big bank name and everybody else knows that same name, they're part of the system. There's a requirement that they cannot loan out 100% of the money that they have on deposit. They have to have reserves on hand or on deposit at, get this, the Federal Reserve. So think of the Federal Reserve as the big bank for the little banks and even the big banks. They've got to have money on deposit in their own storage or at the Federal Reserve earning interest that is there just in case you show up and want your money that you've deposited. When they raise interest rates, that thing that people talk about and nobody ever really explains, when they're talking about raising the interest rate from 0 to 0.25, up to 0.25 to 0.5. This is a very, very tiny interest rate, and it doesn't affect my credit cards. I don't get a 0.5% interest rate on my bank account. Who does that affect? That's the interbank lending rate. That's the rate that banks get for having reserves at the Federal Reserve. It's also the rate that they can charge each other if they loan too much money. So this goes to the banker's hours thing, the jokes about banker's hours and how they close at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock, depending on where you are. This goes back to a long time ago when the Federal Reserve System was there and we didn't have computers. And say you have three loan officers that are sitting around in a bank and they're all talking to people all day long, giving out loans. Well, at the end of the day, they have to sit down together and say, how much money total did we loan out today? And if we loaned out more than we were supposed to, and we don't have enough reserves on hand, we being the ubiquitous we for whoever the bankers are, they've got to go get a loan from another bank or from the Federal Reserve. And that's the interest rate that is charged in the interbank lending rate. So if there's an interest rate charged or paid, what it's saying is that a lot of loans are being made, that there's a big demand for loans all of a sudden. And when you look around at the housing starts and you look around at new houses being purchased, you see that the mortgage demand is up. People are starting to get mortgages again. So that's why they have to say, all right, if the money's too easy to get and anybody can get a loan, then we can get inflation. All right, so there's the background, and hopefully it was not too – we warned you it was a boring program. Hopefully it was not so boring that we had people drooling and driving off the road all over our listening audience. So back to you, sir. You were about to go somewhere after the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. A couple of points that we might want to bear in mind. There's an awful lot that I have to discuss.
Me too.
We've had this wonderful run-up in the market this year, double-digit returns. There's a couple of points to put that in reference. One, or in perspective. One, if you look at the total average annual rate of return over the last 3 years, which is a relatively short period of time, it's the Standard Poor's 500 stock index price return has been 7.66% per year compounded. Now, here's something that was a little bit of a revelation even for me. Our average inflation, according to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. I started to say Consumer Protection something or other.
No, that's the Bureau.
Institute. No. For the last 3 years, has averaged 0.66%. And I know that was an eye-opener for me. We've been talking about the risk of deflation, and it's there. But to realize how little inflation we have. So our average real return in the stock market for the last 3 years has been 7% a year, and the total rise has been like 25% in the last 3 years. But here's what I think is fascinating, and that is almost all of it, over half of it, has come in the last month.
Right.
So that's the way – it's an interesting to me thing about the way the market works is over longer periods of time – you get a return that's pretty consistent. And by the way, that 7% return after inflation is pretty consistent for the last century. The further back you go, the closer it gets to that 7% return. So we've actually had an average market over the last 3 years, despite all the frights and fears and ups and downs and complaints. Now, there's another factor that I wanted to throw in before I pass it back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Since 1928, there have been four times that a Republican took office as president following a Democrat, and at the same time took both houses of the Republican Party, took both houses of Congress. Okay?
Or kept them.
Got them.
Right. Had them.
Basically, so when you have a Republican president elected following an 8-year Democrat president, and in that election, the House and the Senate are Republican. So far, since the Great Depression, no, including the Great Depression, the market has declined in the following years an average of 10%.
Now, that could be very easily misconstrued to hear us be saying that Republicans caused the market to go down.
No.
That's not the case. We're saying this because there are correlations and there are causations. There's are things that cause things to happen, and there's things that correlate with other things. In this case, we have a completely different Republican in the White House and a completely different Republican House and Senate. So going forward, it's going to depend a lot on the investors and how they perceive the confidence in the society going forward. If they believe that there's hope being generated, then they will invest. And if they see that things are about cutting back and about slowing down, then they won't.
Well, here's the fascinating thing. When I say it's fascinating, it's one of those things I'm going to enjoy watching over the next year and see how it turns out, actually for the next several years. And that is that previously, in every one of those cases, when we elected a Republican and the House and the Senate went Republican, they came in on a cut the budget, lower spending, balance the budget mantra. The Democrats, on the other hand, have come in with a let's spend more money.
And raise taxes.
And raise taxes. They generally spent more money than they raised taxes.
Yes.
So what you have, there may be a causal effect there, and that is that historically the Democrats have pumped more money into the economy, which causes more money to be there, which causes more money to be invested in stocks because they're more profitable because there's more money there. Now, this is a reversal this time.
Right. The policies that we're seeing being represented by the president-elect are lower taxes and higher spending.
Yeah.
Which has a tremendous boost to the economy today. It's like taking steroids. We just suddenly are about to get a bunch of performance-enhancing money.
Maybe.
Maybe. If the policies go through, then that's a big, big if. The problem is that just like with steroids, if we're not careful, we'll rack up a lot of debt. And that's one of the problems that Republicans have had in the past, not too even far back in the distant past, recent past, when Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they lowered taxes and increased spending, and we had this huge uptick in debt. That's a very serious issue for the long term. The short term economic boost is going to be pretty amazing. The long term damage may also be pretty amazing. So we have to be very careful going forward.
We have to be careful?
We do.
Oh, okay.
We've got to look at it from the perspective of how do we protect our clients and how do we educate the public so that they can protect themselves in a situation where this is a very easy statement. I think a lot of our listeners either expect to get Social Security or are already getting Social Security. And as people are living longer and debt levels go up in the country, expenses go up, which means we need more debt to pay for the Social Security. Knowing that that may be an issue in the future, and this is the even hotter button, which is defense retirements, and that would be military, civil defense contractors, if they had any kind of employment under the government. The promises given by the government, if they're giving too many promises away, might be broken. And if you can plan on that, if you can say that may happen, I'm not endorsing that it should happen, absolutely not. But when the government is giving away obligations at a rate faster than it can meet them, you've got to look at the danger implicit there and how do you plan for it. If you have any ability to save money away independently, then you should do it, even in retirement. So that's what I mean. Well, we got to be careful going forward.
Read a really good article about, which I thought reflected a lot of reality, about Social Security. And it said the Social Security Trust Fund is an irrelevancy, that they're going to pay Social Security. They may adjust who gets it and how much.
Yeah, the Trust Fund is an irrelevancy. It's a hypothetical thing. We've got a caller. We'll finish that thought.
Okay.
Can you hold on to that thought?
No, I'm done.
All right. We've got a caller on 773-1400. Go ahead, caller.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. I've heard there are a lot of people trying to get people to invest in gold and silver in case of some kind of economic collapse.
Oh, I love to talk about that subject. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, for instance, nowadays they like to harp on what happened in Cyprus, you know, where the people who had money in the banks were forced to, forced to not be able to withdraw money except for a certain amount, and they call that a bail-in or something like that.
Well, this, by the way, is not Cyprus. I know a lot of people get them confused, but suffice to say that gold is a terrible hedge against economic uncertainty in the United States, or much of anywhere else right now.
Well, what they say, though, is if there is an economic collapse and you've invested in silver and gold,
then your silver and gold will become nearly worthless.
Well, no, that the they won't be able to touch your assets, as opposed to if you have worthless, like they say, worthless paper money in the bank, then you'll lose everything you have or something like that.
Okay.
I'm going to hang up and listen and let you guys explain this, because it's very – I hear this on Christian radio stations and all kinds of places.
Well,
I wonder if those people are charlatans.
Yes, they are.
Not necessarily. They may not know they're charlatans. Some of them do. Some of them do.
Anyway, I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Let me hit the historical context, and you can talk about some of the more recent stuff. How's that?
Okay.
All right. We are students of history. We really enjoy history. We look at it and say, this is the story that we've written, where we write down the mistakes that we've made and how we fixed them, or didn't fix them, as the case may be. Every socioeconomic collapse, the ones that are being fear-mongered, all of those in history, you go back to any single one of them, all the way back as far as you want to go, the collapse of the Roman Empire, anything where you're talking about a severe enough collapse that you need gold to pay for things. The gold is worthless, sometimes for hundreds of years afterwards, because you cannot eat gold. Sorry, that's just not something you can do. It right. does not become important as a scarcity item because you can't use it to do anything in a collapse. Now, you might be able to start collecting it for future generations later on down the road to pick it up and say, hey, I've got this, and now what do I do with it? That's important to recognize. And if you think of it this way, there's a really whole series of good histories written in the Roman Empire about local collapses, whether it's from volcanoes or whatever. The price and marketability of gold and silver immediately after that is not good. The price drops through the floor, because the only thing that those people are able to grab as they're leaving the city that's about to be demolished by lava or by any number of other things, armies, they grab their jewels and they grab their gold and they grab their silver. And that means there's a huge influx into the marketplace of people trying to sell those precious items.
But they aren't precious anymore because you can't eat them.
If everybody's trying to sell them at the same time, they're not precious anymore.
Let me tell you something that is precious under those circumstances, and that's chickens.
Chickens and liquor.
Yeah, and cigarettes.
Alcohol.
And cigarettes, yeah. Historically.
So those are things that are, if you just think of a small, very small economic collapse or economic hardship, like the power is out for a weekend.
Mm-hmm. Gold isn't going to do you a lot of good.
No, you show up to a barbecue and people they've got their barbecue out there because their refrigerators are not working anymore. So they're taking all the meat out of the refrigerators and out of the freezers and they're throwing them on the barbecue. You got a block party going on and you show up with a gold piece. If they have any doubt that the electricity will get started again, they don't want your gold. But if you show up with a bottle of Jack Daniels, you're going to get some meat.
Yep.
They're going to be happy that you are there. And that is the sort of thing that if you look at what is needed in a situation like that, it isn't gold. You can't use gold to survive.
So let's get a little more practical for a moment. We had as close to a world economic meltdown as any of us have seen in our lives in 2008 and 2009. We were within hours of a bank collapse that would have shuttered the banks, similar to what we saw in 1934. The banks would have just had to close, and that would have been really awkward, and the paper money wasn't the issue. It's the electronic money that's the issue. Now but if you go back and take a look at what happened to the price of gold, as that economic crisis worsened, the price of gold dropped. Had it gone further, the price of gold would have collapsed. And that's just a fundamental reality, and there's a reason for that. The world price of gold, and we're in a world market, is driven very largely by buyers of gold or sellers of gold in India and, to a lesser degree, China. India they don't trust their banks very much with good reason. I mean, the government just said all of the higher denomination notes,
That are most used,
right, by the end of this year will vanish, and they've stopped allowing people to issue them, which means people aren't getting paid because inflation has driven the smaller notes up to the point where there's just not enough of them to go around. And you would think, okay, that should cause the price of gold to jump. No, it didn't. It caused it to fall.
Because
they were
selling the gold that they had at hand to try to make ends meet.
And so what you have is in a financial crisis of any kind, any significant financial crisis in the future, you'll almost certainly see the price of gold fall. You will see it tend to rise during periods of financial boom. So it's going to basically run up and down. But here's the key thing to understand. Over the very long term, gold has declined in price. It has been declining in price for 600 years. It has little bumps upward. And there's nothing, but over a long term period of time, it becomes less and less expensive to extract gold from rocks. And as a result, you get more gold, so you have an increased supply. Now, I'm going to throw one last item in here that I think that's fairly important about gold.
I've got one more as well.
Well, go ahead.
Back when the Spanish started bringing gold back from the United States, or what was
not with
the United States?
Central America.
From the Americas, from Florida, from the tropics of South America. There was a thought at the time that, the equivalent of the geologists of the time, thought that gold would be in its most abundance in the tropics for some reason, maybe the weather, I don't know. Gold likes to go to the tropics, so that's what they believed. So they spent a lot of time bringing gold back.
I think there's some truth in that. I've been to the tropics, and there's a lot more gold jewelry worn down there,
right,
obviously.
Right,
there
it's hard to see it in the north because it's underneath all those coats.
Right.
So the Spanish brought back a lot of gold, and at the beginning people said it's way too expensive to put together the ships to go over there. You've got a hostile environment. You've got months of travel between here and there, and you're going to be bringing back something. You're not even going to break even. There's no way you can bring it back for the cost of the gold. What happened is that technology increased. They were able to build bigger ships and get bigger ships to guard those bigger ships, and they sent them across the ocean months at a time to bring back lots of gold and caused the price of gold to drop tremendously.
There was about an 80% collapse in the cost of gold and the price of gold. And by the way, it put Europe into a depression.
Yes. Basically, the cost of gold dropped enough, and that was most of the money around at the time was based on gold. And when the price of gold drops like that, you get, in essence, inflation, huge inflation. All right. Where we are today, people are saying the same thing that they said to the Spanish. It's going to cost way too much money to go out there and get that. About asteroids. Because at the end of last year, we had an asteroid pass within two moon orbits from the planet Earth. That asteroid had more platinum in the asteroid than we have discovered throughout human history on Earth. We know where big gold asteroids are. We know where they are. They're huge. And part of the reason why there's this big rush to get into space by these for-profit businesses is because they see those assets. And the first ones to get to them are going to make a lot of money. And the fourth ones to get to them are going to make a lot of money. But the eighth ones to get to them, maybe not.
This is the most important thing, listeners, if you're considering that the advertisements to sell gold. Now, I want to emphasize what I just said. The smart people who put these advertisements together are spending a tremendous amount of money to sell their gold.
While telling you it's important to buy gold.
Right.
They're selling.
They're not. The point is, if the smart people are spending a lot of money, the smart rich people are spending a lot of money in order to sell their gold, that's probably the thing to do at that point is sell your gold, not buy it. They're trying to convince you to be a sucker and buy the gold that they want to sell. If indeed gold was going to double in value or go up tremendously into the future,
why would they sell it to you?
Why would they be spending a lot of advertising money convincing you to buy it from them? In other words, they want to get rid of their gold to you who are not economically sophisticated, and they are economically, they claim to be economically sophisticated. So they're really sophisticated. They really know what they're talking about, and they want to unload their gold and get you to buy it. That should be an indicator to you that they don't expect the price of that gold they're selling to you to go up. They don't. They really don't. It's kind of like there's a lot of money spent selling big screen TVs. A lot of advertising spent on big screen TVs. Take a look at the historic price of any given model of television, and you will discover that it declines rapidly. You probably have no great hope if you buy a TV to hang on your wall that in 5 years you'll be able to sell it for more money than you paid for it.
That's probably not why you bought the TV.
But that is why they want to sell it. They want to sell those things as quickly as they can, because if they hang on to them for a year, they'll be worth less. If you see the gold advertisements completely dry up,
that may be a time to buy gold.
And you see a lot of people saying, if you have any gold, we will pay you above market price for it. A lot of those advertisements. Now, you do see a few of those around right now, but that's because if you look at the markups that they play, the markdown or markup, what they're paying you, it's substantially below what they can resell the gold for, which is just a good profit margin. But when you see, we will buy your gold in any form or fashion at 20% or 10% or whatever above the open market value, well, then
that's a good time to sell.
No, it's a good time to buy.
It's a good time to buy.
That's the time you should go out and be buying gold, but you probably won't find anybody who'll sell it to you, because the smart people who have lots of gold obviously won't sell it. Now, let me give you number three here. This is important. If you take physical possession of the gold, unless it's in a coin that is very, very, very well respected and is sealed in plastic, and it's a collector's item, if you take physical possession of the gold, then it has to be reassayed before you can sell it again. Now, here it gets worse.
That costs money.
If you don't take physical possession of the gold, and that's what most gold buyers don't, they don't take possession, take a little piece of paper. There is no guarantee at all that that gold is there. And there have been situations time and time and time again where the purveyors of gold who sell certificates to you that you have gold in a vault someplace
don't
sell
have that gold.
They sell the same gold 20 times over, and in some cases they don't have any gold at all. But they usually have some gold, so people can say, here's our gold, here it is, that we can, you see the gold right there. But if you ever try to get your money back,
or your gold,
or the
matter.
Gold, you will discover that it's not there. And gold is scary. It's not regulated by the SEC.
It's a commodity.
And it's
no more regulated than bacon.
Actually, bacon is
more
regulated.
Bacon is regulated for eating, but if you're buying pork bellies, if you just want, hey, I have a contract for pork bellies, well, there's no entity out there that is going to say, well, I guess there is.
Yeah,
it's more regulated.
There is. There's more regulation on meat by far than there is on gold. Gold is basically excluded from almost any form of federal regulation. Civil fraud, if you determine that if you can prove against their army of lawyers that they committed fraud, which is going to be very, very difficult to do in today's environment, you have some defense. But basically, it's unregulated, and as a result, people can come on the television or on the radio, and they can say whatever they want to about gold, and nobody's going to get on them for it. So gold is a very, very, very poor inflation hedge. It's a very, very, very poor crisis hedge. Actually, the smart money around the world has an inflation and crisis hedge, and it has paid off very, very well for them. And it's called that supposedly worthless paper money. It's called dollars. People around, that's why the dollar is up so substantially. So it's like $1.04 per 1 euro, where it used to be 1.40, is because the really smart, wealthy people in the world look around and say, that's the secure place to have money is in dollars.
Right. And if you think about the people selling the gold on those advertisements,
they want dollars.
They want dollars. They're trading you gold for dollars, yep. And they're telling you that the dollars are worthless while they're taking those dollars from you with a very large smile. Okay, we've got some commercials that we need to play. So on the other end of this, we'll have more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I've got some subjects to talk about. I wanted to talk about the price of oil and kind of the same context that we were with gold. Mm-hmm. And we got some other stuff as well, lots of other stuff.
Well, the price of olive oil has gone up.
Olive oil, yes.
Or down. I'm sorry. It's gone down. I'm sorry. Right.
So we'll be back on the other end. If you'd like to join us, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here remain, of course, area code 254-773-1400. Now, it's not actually numbers in the sense of there are multiple telephone lines.
They're just numbers in the phone number.
Yeah, like 254-773-1400 is a bunch of numbers.
Yeah.
So it's numbers. The telephone number?
Number?
Or numbers?
One number, I guess. Yeah.
Now, if you're calling from outside the United States, you should call 1+. Actually, 01+, all of those numbers.
I love the format that they put those numbers in with a little dash. Have you ever tried to push the dash on your phone?
Do you know why that's there?
I know why it was there. I don't know why it's still there.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when telephone numbers were either three or four. Our telephone number was a three-digit number when I was a kid. And you picked up the phone, and they had a voice that said, "Operator." And they all had the same accent. I still never quite understood. They went to training for that. Okay.
Seriously.
And you told them like 395, which was our telephone number when I was a kid. I had to memorize that before I could go to school. And then in the larger cities, very quickly, they set up multiple exchanges. And what that meant is there were literally physical places where operators sat and plugged plugs into the bank of plugs, like if you may have seen on some pictures or movies or something. Those were called exchanges. And what happened is you had multiple exchanges, so they were all named after a street or the local community. Like, so it would be Evergreen 4295 would be the telephone number. Well, they concluded when they went digital and they started in – it's actually analog, but the switching was digital. It was click, 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 click. When the dials came – they switched those names to numbers. So 773 would be Temple's. It's probably Temple 1400 at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we got into bigger and bigger areas, we came up with area codes, and that's where we are now.
Just as another side note, if anybody out there is involved in music and use an electric instrument of some kind, that quarter-inch plug that you use. If you've ever wondered why that's the plug that's used, it's used because there were a series of people that were really inventing electric instruments. And they all ran into the same situation. They needed a plug to plug their electric instrument into an amplifier.
Mm-hmm.
They got those plugs on surplus from the phone company.
Right.
So now we have a standard plug for our electric instruments.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the most efficient by any stretch. I mean, otherwise your iPhone would have this big old gaping jack hole in it. Jack hole may or may not be repeatable. I don't know. That hole is not that size, and now the new iPhones don't even have the little hole anymore. The reason why that jack existed was because it was surplus from the telephone companies.
Absolutely. Hey, back to the Economics?
Yes, there's an echo of nomics in here.
The dollar this week hit a 14-year high against a basket of currencies. It is roughly equal to where it was, obviously, 14 years ago. Against many of the major currencies is about where it was at its highest point in 2015. The difference is it shows every indication of continuing to rise in value as people buy dollars and sell the other currencies. Now, why are they doing that? Because our economy is growing strongly enough that our Federal Reserve feels obliged to take some of the stimulus away. We're not back to neutral yet and won't be probably until next year on interest rates. Interest rates are still what we call stimulative. In other words, they tend to make the economy run a little faster. But they're raising rates, whereas in Europe, the European Central Bank is still using stimulus of buying bonds on the open market to try and flushing money into the market to try to get them out of the edge of a recession. Japan remains on the edge of a recession. So we're in this interesting position where the dollar has risen amazingly. It's a dollar, a Canadian dollar now is worth $1.33. And I mean, well, let me put it like $1.33 of Canadian dollar equals $1 of US dollar, which means that you get a very substantial discount on everything you buy in Canada. The same thing is true if you go to Europe right now. The pricing in Europe is based on a relationship between the dollar and the euro of $1.40. It used to take $1.40 to buy a single euro. Their prices have not run up to compensate for that differential. As a matter of fact, they've had a deflationary problem, so their prices have actually declined a little bit. So you can get roughly both in Canada and in Europe, you go to buy something, you're paying roughly a third less than the locals are paying for it, just because you're using the U.S. dollar, which of course brings us back to the issue of the U.S. dollar being the currency around the world that is considered to be the stable place or the place to put your money. The Chinese are putting more and more restrictions on capital outflows. There used to be some loopholes.
Right. They've gotten rid of those loopholes. They're
trying to close the loopholes.
There's still one major loophole that's working quite well.
Which one?
The Chinese mega wealthy are setting up companies in the United States, doing business with a company in the United States that they already own, and then suing themselves
right.
with the company in the right. United States for non-performance.
Right.
So what they do is
and then company, not defending themselves.
And then not defending, or at least not defending themselves very well, and losing to these huge amounts of money, which in China gives them a tax write-off.
And requires them by law to ship a lot of money to the United States.
Right. So they're doing it as fast as they can. Now, they are suing themselves to get money out of China.
So you think, well, that's really crazy. Why are they doing that? They're doing it because people are so afraid of China and so concerned that China is going to do something or they're going to manipulate currency or something like that. The bottom line to it is they want to get their money out of the Chinese yuan or renminbi, they're both legitimate names for it,
just like
into U.S. dollars. Now, this is a very important point. Poor people in China are buying gold. Wealthy yeah. people in China
are selling gold.
Are buying dollars and selling gold. So anyone who says to you that the dollar could collapse, could become worthless.
Not anytime soon.
Well, not only that, but ultimately if the dollar were to collapse and become worthless, you would have chaos in the world. And if you showed up with a gold bar, very shortly what you would really need is more blood.
Yes.
Because you'd get your throat slit and somebody take it from you.
All right, so on that lovely note, I'm going to switch over to oil. So, you know, leaving that imagery in your mind for a moment, sorry about that. The oil prices today are up a bit. The price per barrel in the West Texas Intermediate, which is kind of the United States benchmark, is about $50. Overseas, the sweet crude that's out there is selling right around $54, $55 a barrel. That's for 33 gallons, not 50 gallons in the barrel. All right, so what does that mean? Why am I telling you this? Well, number one, that's a little bit higher than it was even just a couple of weeks ago because of the OPEC meeting and people going, oil. Okay, I'm going to now tell you about some amazing scientific and technological advances in the fracking world. It's funny, and when you're talking about geology and getting minerals out of the ground, technology takes a different form. We're used to thinking of technology as some kind of electronic gizmo, maybe something magnetic, I don't know, maybe fiber optic, some kind of cool gizmos out there. And there's some of that because the software that they're using and the methods that they're using to map the underground before drilling is really nice, but that really hasn't advanced a lot in the last 5 years. The biggest technological advance in the last year in the fracking world, and it's huge because it causes the price to the break-even point to drop by 75%. Did you catch that?
I did.
75% drop in costs in fracking So not that long ago, it cost $70. The break-even point for a company would be $70 a barrel to get the oil out of a fracking well. They have dropped that price by 75%, and there's a just real quick, this is from Chesapeake Energy. This is not a recommendation for them because it's pretty similar across the board because this technology exists across the board. The break-even point for most of the fracking potential out there, the highest expensive break-even point at fracking is $40 a barrel now, not 70. And you're down in the $35 a barrel range in a lot of the different basins that they're doing this fracking. What fracking is they are basically high pressure blowing acid and other chemicals underground to demolish shale and then sucking it back up and separating the oil out of the shale. So it's there. It's been hiding in tiny little pockets. But when you destroy the shale, shale's just, it's like compressed clay. So it's water soluble, but with acid, and you could basically turn shale into clay with enough rain because there's some acid in the rain. Well, you add other acids to it and it happens really fast and it releases all that oil. The grand new technology, this thing that's lowering the cost tremendously, is sand. Yes, this is the new technology, folks. Sand. They're pumping sand in the slurry, and that opens up the cracks that the water is using and the acids and chemical bath is using to open up the cracks and get more of the shale.
So we should buy sand futures?
Right. Let's buy sand futures immediately. And if you're going to the beach and suddenly the beach is no more and you just see a big Exxon ship leaving, you know what happened. No, there's enough sand out there, folks. We've got deserts all over the place. Sand is not in a short supply. But as a technology, most people don't think that sand is anyway a great technology, except that it's good for glass, for polishing, and for creating glass. It's also very good for stabilizing the ground underneath us while fracking, as well as getting the oil out cheaper. So a lot of the earthquakes are from putting that acid wash, that stuff that they were using that they don't know what to do with, they're pumping it back into the ground, and we're about out of time. So for this hour, if you'd like to contact us off the air at the Personal Wealth Coach, we give advice to high net worth people. The phone number to call locally is
947-1111.
You can reach that number toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our philosophy. If you didn't get enough insanity, you can listen to our podcasts. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.